I still see some people joining, but I think we can probably get started. The etiquette on Zoom is that the 5 minutes you usually used to give in seminars has become 2 minutes on webinars. So let me just welcome all of you. Thank you very much for joining. This is the first public event in Michaelmas term for the International Inequalities Institute at the LSE. My name is Chico Ferreira, and I'll be chairing this event. And I'm delighted to have with us here today Luca Chancel and Alina Avancharkova. Let me briefly introduce them to you. Luca, the seminar is basically Luca will be presenting to us and discussing his new book called Unsustainable Inequalities, Social Justice and the Environment, which is just a fascinating topic because it brings together, I guess, the two sort of defining challenges of our time, right? How to bring together social justice with environmental sustainability and responsibility. Luca is one of the co-directors of the World Inequality Lab at the Paris School of Economics. He's also a lecturer at Sciences Po University in Paris and a co-author of the World Inequality Report in 2018. One of the most influential people working on inequality, particularly in top incomes and wealth in the world today. He's also a senior research fellow at the Institute for Sustainable Development and International Relations. So welcome, Luca. We're very happy to have you here today. And we're also very happy to have Alina Avancharkova, who is a distinguished policy fellow at the Grantham Research Institute on Climate Change and the Environment here at the LSE, where she leads the governance and legislation research theme. Before passing on to the speakers, let me just very briefly say that in a moment you'll be able to see on the chat function a link to all upcoming III events, as well as a link through which you can subscribe to our newsletter, which will keep you informed about the events. We have a rich menu this year. Just next week, we have one on culture is bad for you, inequality in the cultural and creative industries with Dave Bryan from Edinburgh, and one on is the economy racist with Faisal Shaheen, Wilf Sullivan, and Nunlana Makuyana. So those are in case you are available next week. Before handing over to Luca, let me just say the event is being recorded. It'll be available in video and podcast from our website soon after the event. The way we're going to do, we're going to have Luca talk for about half an hour, then Alina for about 10 minutes or so. We'll have, 15, 20 minutes for questions at the end. Please type your questions in the chat, in the Q&A function, rather, in the Q&A function on the bottom of your screen. And I'll read from those when we get there. You can start with questions whenever you want. They'll be gathered there, and I'll pick from those at the end. So thanks very much for joining again, and over to Luca, please.
Can you all see my screen? Okay. Well, thank you so much, Francisco, for the invitation. I'm really glad to present this book. You know, in the current context, I think it's also really interesting that this can be done online. We're reducing our carbon emissions and we're still exchanging ideas. So that's fantastic. All right, so this book was actually not written during or after COVID. So if you expect some things about, you know, the COVID pandemics, well, it's not going to be exactly about that. That being said, even being written before COVID, I think it's still very relevant to the kind of issues and discussions that we've been having since the beginning of the year. And of course, the pandemics and the economic crisis that follows it is exacerbating many forms of inequalities. When you look at inequalities on the labor market, when you look at income inequalities, when you look at wealth inequalities, and we see that, you know, this huge increase and rise in the wealth of the world's top billionaires since March, about $2 trillion extra in the hands of the world's richest persons, when, you know, incomes at the bottom of the distribution in so many countries are collapsing, you know, we observe this reality, which is a reality of growing inequality due to this shock, the COVID shock, that hit societies where that were already unequal. And these societies, we've been discussing this in many other publications, and you know, the global community of inequality researchers is very rich, with many groups producing analysis showing that there has been a rise in inequality at different speeds, but more or less generalized over the past 30 years across the world. Now, the main point of this book is that when environmental shocks, and to some extent COVID is a form of environmental shock, since, you know, it largely can be associated to the changes in natural habitats in some parts of the world, which makes more probable the transfer of germs or viruses from animal populations to human populations. The point of the book is basically to discuss and to try to better understand what happens to unequal societies when these shocks get to these societies. And when I'm talking about environmental shocks, I'm also thinking about droughts, about fires, and we see those in the on the West Coast in the US as we are speaking right now, about floods. We've had some floods, important floods in the southeast of France over the past few days, hurricanes. All of these events hit societies, and hit everybody in societies, but not everybody in the same way. And there's this fairly, you know, general understanding in the environmental inequality literature, which is that low-income individuals, those at the bottom of the social ladder, are generally more exposed to these shocks and more vulnerable to them, because they live in areas that are more exposed to floods or hurricanes, for instance. And once these hurricanes or floods reach them, then they have more difficulties to get back to normal life. So this exacerbates inequalities. And the general question that the book asks is how, you know, to avoid this in the future, how to rethink our social system, both in a way that better protects the environment and that also thinks about, you know, all the social security mechanisms that we know of, how to rethink them in the light of these environmental challenges. And right, so I won't be, let me try to move to the next slide. I won't be discussing, you know, all the book here. I'll just try to give a little flavor of what those who are interested in reading it may find in the book. Just saying that it's split in three parts. In the first one, I discuss what I call here unsustainable development patterns. And I start with this important moment, I think, in global policy analysis, this important moment of 2012 at the Rio conference in Brazil, where the global community, for the first time, I think, really brings together the social dimension of policy and the environmental dimension of policy. And before 2012, there was this idea that we could have climate negotiations on the one side, environmental topics discussed on the one side, and social policy discussed on the other. We were discussing poverty and millennium goals about poverty reduction separately from climate negotiations. What is new from 2012 onwards is that inequality is now a sustainable development issue. It needs to be thought along with environmental problems. And I think this is very important and this is very interesting. That being said, it's not sufficient to declare these grand ideas. It's also necessary to look at how policies are actually made. And this is what I try to do in this book. But okay, so that's part one, the sources of unsustainable development. Part two is trying to get into this complexity, trying to think beyond what we could call a standard view, which could be that, for instance, you know, when you start to realize that environmental degradation is a problem and might exacerbate inequality, then a logical conclusion could be that let's protect the environment and everything will be fine. Let's protect the environment and, you know, inequality will be somewhat magically reduced. In this part two, I'd like to show that actually it's more complex than that. And I'll show a few slides on this in a second. And part three is about some policy discussions and about what could be done. I tried to keep this book relatively slim. So it's really, you know, trying to be an overview and an introduction to these questions with some specific details, some own research, and some I'm also trying to bring research of colleagues that are working on this topic. And I'm sure there's you know, still a lot to be discussed, and I'll be very happy to discuss this with you at the end of this session. So why is the relationship between environmental protection and inequality not that simple? And why do we need to get into the complexity of these interactions? Here is a picture, an illustration of the Yellow Vest movement in France, 2019. Where, for those of you who were not really exposed to what happened, even though, you know, the Yellow Vest were world famous to some extent, the government wanted to increase the tax rate on fossil fuels through, you know, an increase in the tax on carbon. This was an environmental policy, very clearly presented. But at the same time, what the government, the French government, was doing is that it was scrapping the wealth tax. So to use precise numbers, taxes on carbon were going to increase by 4 billion euros, and taxes on top French wealthy individuals were declining by 4 billion euros. So, you know, people, you know, are not all, you know, statisticians or looking at, you know, numbers all day long. But in that case, it was fairly easy to see that, you know, there was some kind of transfer between people feeling that they were being taxed on oil and something that they had no other choice than to use in order to go to work or to go to do their shopping. And this money was actually being used to detax other peoples that don't necessarily need it at this point of time. So there was a big social unrest, and this led to actually the scrapping of this policy. There is no carbon tax in France at the moment, at least the increase was frozen. So in the end, the point I'm trying to make here is that when climate policies are blind to inequality concerns, they are very likely to fail. And of course, there are very different ways through which governments can pursue environmental objectives. There can be more or less inequality enhancing ways, and this is what is essential to look at when these governments design climate policies. And I will try to show in a few slides, you know, ideas and elements to try to better design these climate policies. What I want to show in the next slide is that this is not just a rich country's problem. This tension between social objectives on the one hand and environmental objectives on the other, you know, has been seen in many countries in the world over the past decade or 15 years. This is just another example. So from Indonesia, where you had a series of fossil fuel reforms in the 2010 onwards. And at the beginning, and I will show a bit later that Indonesia, actually what happened later on and how the whole discussions developed, this turned into a relatively positive story. But first let's look at these tensions. The government tries to reduce the fossil fuels, the fossil fuel subsidies. And well, you know, inevitably all the people who were depending on these fossil fuel subsidies that were reducing the amount of money that we're spending on fuels, on basic goods, went to the streets. And so you had large-scale social unrest. This also happened in Nigeria. This also happened in Ecuador at the end of last year. So it's a very kind of general tension that is seen, observed throughout the world. This conflict between environmental policy and social policy. And then I'm turning to another example, which is fairly relevant in the context, I think, of the current US presidential campaign, where you have here coal miners. Coal miners that are largely against the US climate policy, and that have been against over the past years and perhaps decades, and who were used as an excuse or as a justification by Donald Trump when the US government decides to move out of the Paris Climate Agreement. So, you know, whether this was out of genuine interest for the coal miners or out of electoral interest, from the point of view of Donald Trump, is not the question. The question is more, why is it that up to recently, there was no clearly articulated plan in the US to compensate these miners, to make sure that those who are potentially losing from these transitions that the rest of society will benefit from, to make sure that these guys will not be losing from it. So this is what I discuss in the book, and I'd like to, you know, kickstart the discussion with, you know, just a brief overview of what can be done. So what can be done? 3 points. The first one I would say is we need to better map and track these new forms of inequalities, what I call here the social ecological inequalities. So this is also, you know, a researcher's bias, because this is what we do at the World Inequality Lab. We try to track and monitor the evolution of inequalities from a global perspective and a comparative perspective. What I think here is important and interesting is that there can be synergies between what researchers do, but also what activists do on the field, what groups of lawyers do when it comes to try to protect communities from different types of pollution. So this is a necessary condition for other forms of policies to be properly implemented and a necessary condition to properly tackle these issues of, you know, potential tensions between environmental protection and social objectives, inequality reduction. The second point is about the importance of public services. And what I call here social ecological public services, I will show just a few examples, but I'm trying to reconcile this general idea that, you know, is it, how do you reduce inequalities? Is it through pre-distribution? So basically all the stuff in which you invest in order to, you know, generate higher incomes for everybody without having to tax the rich. I'm actually trying to reconcile these views. We need predistribution, especially in the field of environmental inequalities. We need to better to invest in health system, in low carbon infrastructures. We need to invest in a redesigned way to do social work, and social workers need to integrate some environmental concerns in their work. I'll say just one word on that. But we also need to redistribute in the sense that we need to finance these investments, and taxing wealthy polluters is one way to do so. So let me move on. And mapping environmental inequalities, well, this map is just an example using the case of the US before, you know, Donald Trump really started to scrap down the Environmental Protection Agency. I think the US was relatively ahead of other countries when it comes to mapping land pollutants, air pollutants, water pollutants with this tool that I'm presenting here, the Risk Screening Environmental Indicator. The interest of this kind of tool, in my sense, is that it enables some discussion and dialogue between experts you know, working on the different types of pollutants, the, you know, the pollution levels, but also those on the ground that could actually challenge some of the data that they were seeing and send back this information to the people actually fueling the model and fueling the maps with some data. So some interesting back and forth between expertise in the lab and expertise in the ground. The general point I want to make here is that, you know, most countries are really, really at stage zero of, you know, mapping environmental pollutants. And there needs to be, you know, huge efforts in this domain. Now, we need to know who is impacted by pollution, but when it comes to try to prevent events like the yellow vests or prevent events like, you know, unrest when fossil fuel subsidies are removed, we also need to know really who pollutes. Here I'm presenting data from, you know, what we're doing at the World Inequality Lab. I present some of this data in the book. And this is a global perspective on the issue where I show that the top 10% in the world are responsible for about half of all carbon emissions. This is what you see on the graph, top 10% since 1970. So we see that, you know, carbon emissions is a relatively highly concentrated issue. And perhaps, you know, focusing on the top 10% really is going to already do a lot of the efforts that we need to do. The problem here is that, you know, countries are not producing such information year on year. And it shouldn't be the case that researchers have to produce this, this data. Here I'm using the same data on carbon emissions inequality at the global level, but presenting it in a slightly different way. This is, you know, a now famous, I guess, growth incidence curve, to take the wording of Branko Milanovic and his colleague Chris Lackner at the World Bank. But here I'm doing a growth incidence curve that looks like an elephant curve on carbon growth. So what you see here is the poorest people on Earth on the left, the richest people on Earth on the right. And for each of these group, the rate of growth in their emissions, in their carbon emissions. And what you see is, you know, the rise of the emerging middle class. You see also that actually the middle class in the West or in the global North has been reduced. Their emissions have reduced over the past 40 to 50 years. So there has been some progress, really clearly not enough, but there is a reduction in terms of per capita emissions in the middle class and the working class in the West. But at the very top of the global distribution, there's a strong increase. Well, my point here is that we should have such information every year in every country, and not only at the global level, but really in every country. And this will really make it possible to really better design the environmental taxes that we want to implement in some places, or the types of investments in low carbon infrastructures that we want to do in others. So we need to better know who is polluting and who is benefiting from polluting policies. This data that I mobilize in the book, but this is not actually produced by me. This is the amount of money that is captured by each income group from the lowest quintile, the poorest 20% on the left of the graph here to the richest 20% on the right. Fossil fuel subsidy captured by different income groups throughout the world. And we see that these fossil fuel subsidies, so when the government, you know, subsidizes the price of fossil fuels, this largely benefits rich people in the emerging world. But once again, remember the one of the first picture, it's not because the rich largely benefit from these subsidies that scrapping them and removing them will be harmless for the poor. And this can still create a lot of tensions if these policies are not adequately integrating these inequality concerns when they are implemented. So how can we actually do social ecological policies? That is, you know, environmental policies that do not increase inequality and perhaps that actually reduce them. So here are a few examples, which I think are fairly interesting and give an idea of the general story that I'm trying to discuss in this book. Invest in social ecological public services. I started this presentation by saying that in Indonesia, the first attempts to remove fossil fuel subsidies were, you know, led to a lot of social tensions. But then what the government did is fairly interesting in my sense. What the government did is that it used this money not just to pay government debts or to do, you know, other forms of policies. It actually used this amount of money to increase cash transfers to low-income households, to increase transfers to finance education, and to create universal healthcare system. And here you can see on this graph the decrease of fossil fuel subsidies as a share of GDP, 3% in 2005. This was huge. You know, when you compare to government budget, that was about 6 to 7% at the time. You know, you had 50% of government budget that was going to fossil fuel subsidies. So what you have here is some form of social ecological reform where you tax pollution and you use that money to invest in new forms of social protections. And I think really this is really going in the right direction. This is the Indonesian healthcare system. Another example, and now I move on to the global north, Sweden. Sweden today has the highest carbon tax rate in the world, and it doesn't seem to bother the Swedes too much. How could they do that? Well, actually, what the Swedes did in from the 1980s onwards is that they largely invested, and this is the green area of this graph here, they largely invested in renewable technologies, in affordable, municipally owned energy infrastructures, making it possible when the carbon tax is implemented from the early 1990s onwards, and then it rises afterwards, for people to have a choice. Either you pay the carbon tax or you switch to this relatively cheap, renewable municipal heating systems. And I'm here showing just some pipes for the sake of the illustration. This is the kind of, you know, investments, and this is a form of public service, municipally owned public service of energy transition that is required if you want to have relatively aggressive climate policies afterwards. You need to give citizens, people, consumers, alternatives. And if these investments are not made, there's no alternative, and then you get to the yellow vests. Now, it's not just about building pipes and building infrastructures. These are extremely important, but here, I just want to mention one point, which is about social work. In Sweden, you also have a system of social protection that really integrates social concern, let's say traditional social concerns, so difficulty to pay, you know, your rent or, you know, cash transfers in the case of unemployment. But this is coupled with a general understanding of the needs of households which integrate energy constraints and energy needs. So you have these social workers that actually basically do some form of energy audit to make sure that the support, the aid provided by the state or provided by the region actually includes the cost of energy for living. In so many countries in Europe and in the US, you have the social and the environmental administrations that work in silos. They do not communicate with one another. They do not have similar training. They do not understand the work of the other. And this is extremely important when we want to think about what social security should look like in the 21st century in rich countries, but also how, you know, these new forms of social securities that are emerging in the global south can look like. So this is about, this is not just about pipes, this also is about the formation of social worker and how they are trained and how administration stop working in silos on these issues. And let me conclude on this. How do we finance all this? You know, there's been a very large literature on taxing the wealthy. There's also a large literature on taxing carbon. Here, I just would like to throw in a few ideas to the debate. First, the emerging world. In the emerging world, I really think that there is a window of opportunity at the moment to tax pollution and to tax, you know, things like heavy SUVs, air transport, you know, or a lot of, you know, consumption items that are highly polluting and that so far are not that much used by the middle class, are largely consumed by the upper class, and that are not used at all by the bottom income groups. This window of opportunity means that basically if you don't do it now, in 10 years, it's too late. In 10 years, you know, taxing these forms of goods, very large cars, for instance, will be regressive. If you do it now, you have much more chances to do progressive policies that are very limited to your top income groups. But then when it comes to taxing pollution and taxing the rich, I think we really need to address not only consumption, but also the carbon content of assets, rich people's investment. Here, this is just a very slight extension from what's in the book with new data, but I think I lay the ground for this discussion in the book. Here I show that, you know, between 1975 to 2020, we see the evolution of the emissions of the global top 1%. And so their level of carbon emissions is about 140 tons per year per capita. Half of this today can actually be related to the assets they own, to their investments. So we need to think beyond simple and pure consumption carbon taxes, and we need to move in our own thinking and reflections about taxing assets and taxing investments. And final point, it's also going to be, how do we ensure that this energy transition is fair? It's also going to be about the types of models of ownership of, you know, the new energy technologies that we develop. I show again this graph on Sweden, where you see the rise of biomass in the energy heating mix of Sweden, this biomass being largely municipally owned. You know, we can go for energy transitions that are, you know, massively in which the assets are massively concentrated as they are today. We can also decide, you know, to have mixed and alternative forms of ownership. It can be municipally owned, like in the case of, you know, heating system in Sweden. It can be cooperatives, like in the case of Germany. Here you see the strong rise of energy cooperatives that are owned by individuals or farmers in Germany. This has been picking up, and this is really an ownership model that is very different from your other, you know, standard business ownership models. Here it's one person that has one share when it comes to voting decisions and voting rights. So I think it's really important to think about the fact that energy transition can be made in a very unequal manner, and it can be made in a more equal manner. There's no predetermined vision, predetermined story here. It's all about political choice. So I'll stop here. I think there is much more that could be said in the book. I'll be very happy to listen to your comments and the discussion. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Luca. That was a wonderful tour of a very rich book, but you summarized it very nicely. Let me turn straight away to Alina for about 10 minutes or so for her comments and discussion. Thank you.
So inequality is multifaceted. It has many faces. It's not just about income distribution. It's about access to health, education. It's about social status. It's also about access to environmental resources and safe water and air. And Lucas's book makes an excellent job in unpacking these different aspects of inequality from the point of view of an economist, and then linking it to the issues of sustainable development, issues of equality around access to natural resources, about exposure to environmental risks to which we're not exposed equally, risk inequality in terms of responsibility for environmental damage, and also the say in the decision making about environmental policies that are implemented. To me, I think the book makes a very interesting analysis, asking a question whether addressing inequality essentially through the economic growth does necessarily need to lead to increase in environmental degradation, as some of the past empirical studies which look at ex post analysis of what happened in the history claim, or whether there is an alternative way to do that. And effectively, Lucas answers very clearly that yes, there is a way to address social inequalities and to address pressing environmental issues that the world faces, as I think his presentation has given quite a few examples of how he does that. For me, the key quote which resonated with me from Lucas's book was that inequality is a matter of political choice. And I really couldn't agree more with that. And I think the challenge as we look forward is how to make sure that the political choices we make going forward allow us to address both improve inequality and address pressing environmental issues, such as the global crisis of climate change, the area that I focus on. So I wanted to pick up on these themes and discuss it a little bit in the context of what we're currently facing with the global pandemics and the COVID-19 crisis. So, of course, nobody would argue that COVID-19 is one of the most challenging health and now turning into a profound social and economic crisis that we have faced in the past several decades. We do, however, also have a more profound, longer-term crisis upon us, which is the one of global climate change. And I think it is safe to say that the two crises will exacerbate each other, and I'll discuss a little bit more in more detail. So I think COVID-19, the estimates of different international agencies clearly point to deepening of inequalities as a result of the pandemic we're currently facing. For example, International Labour Organization has estimated that 1.6 billion workers, which are mostly engaged in the informal sector, constituting about half of the global workforce, are in the immediate danger to their livelihoods being destroyed due to the impacts of the crisis that we are facing. We also seen some data that just as a result of the COVID-19 crisis this year, about 1.5 billion children have missed on their education this year, which will have profound negative impact on their future. And so I think needless to say that has very direct impact on inequalities around the world growing. Now, if we think about the crisis of climate change, the pandemic creates additional pressure on the priorities in the political domain, potentially being devoted to other issues. And so the question, I think, linking to Lucas's quote in the book is, can we make a political choice which helps us address the pandemic and also address the crisis of climate change? And I think we definitely can. I think Lucas has outlined some of the measures which could be implemented, but I wanted to mention a few very concrete examples. So McKinsey has estimated that the global recovery package to help countries come out of the consequences of the pandemics is estimated at about $10 trillion globally. Now, if we think about the resources devoted to addressing climate change, those of you who follow international climate change negotiations, for years we've been arguing about how to mobilize $100 billion annually to help developing countries address the impacts of climate change and to reduce emissions. In the context of the pandemic, we are mobilizing resources on the order of much, much higher magnitude than that. So why not think about solutions which help us both help vulnerable populations and also address climate change? And those solutions are right in front of us. I'll just give a couple of examples. Investing in renewable and green energy rather than brown energy. Studies have shown that every $1 million of investment diverted from brown energy to green energy, say to renewables or to energy efficiency, creates 5 additional jobs. So there is a net gain in job creation rather than a job loss, as some critics of climate action argue. There is a potential to stimulate households. I think Lucas in his book mentions that some of the most profitable investments in terms of decarbonization and inequality benefits are helping vulnerable households to improve energy efficiency and insulation of their homes. So UK currently launched a green grant, green home grant, which would help households to finance the cost of reducing energy bills, insulating homes, and at the same time creating jobs in the construction sector. And I can go on, we have plenty of those examples. So I think picking on the message from the book, I think it's very important to make it a matter of political choice that we use the current sad and very devastating crisis as an opportunity and address both objectives together as we start coming out of it. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Alina. Thank you. The nice complimentary thoughts there to Lucas's book. So what I propose we do is that maybe I read 3 questions at a time, group them together. You guys can take notes so you don't forget the questions. So just 3, so we're efficient in the use of time. And then I'll turn to Lucas to answer them. And Lucas, feel free in your answer to these first 3 questions, if you want to respond to anything that Alina said, feel free to do that as well. And hopefully we'll have time for a second round. But in the first round, here's a question from Mustafa Katouf from Morocco. This is now me saying something, not him, but you talked about investment, of course, in infrastructure. You showed those pipes in Sweden. He's asking about investments somewhere else. So he says, can the European Union make new green investments in Africa, like renewable energy, to stop illegal immigration and to create a new market for European youth to work together with African youth? So that's one question about green investment from Europe into Africa. A second question from Angela Pachon is how to make carbon taxes less regressive. It seems that tax neutrality is not enough. And the third one from Andrea Quintas, it says, thank you for this lecture. Is it a coincidence that the chart about the growth of the global environmental inequalities, the elephant curve, is quite similar to the graph of global inequality growth in general? How do you explain that? Thank you. So let's do these 3 maybe, and then we can come back. Luca, over to you.
Thank you very much for the questions and for the discussion. Perhaps just first, picking up on the discussion and on the COVID exchange, I think it's what happened in the context of COVID is also, you know, very interesting for, you know, what for perhaps reopening the space of, you know, of policy tools that we have when we think about reducing inequalities in a finite world. We've seen that in a few weeks. The overall narrative change, right? And if, you know, when we get pre-COVID, the general narrative is that, you know, it's impossible to, you know, for governments to set prices in a lot of sectors of the economy. It's impossible to put quotas. It's impossible to stop airlines from functioning. It's impossible to direct the production of the economy in many countries. And I'm thinking here a lot about countries like the European Union or the US, but it also applies to other countries. And we see that in a few weeks, this became possible. So I'm not saying that it's going to be easy to set quotas, to fix prices, to kickstart the production of certain, you know, key energy sectors in the future. But I'm saying that the general narrative, which is to say that, you know, this can't be done because it's the laws of the market, doesn't hold. And I think the COVID crisis is a clear example of that, and should, you know, always be reminded in the coming months and years when we hear again these discussions about it's all about, you know, market price. Now, with respect to the questions, first, investments. Should the EU invest in North Africa, you know, in solar panels, for instance? You know, I think here, what I'm trying to advocate in the book is that, you know, there's going to be, you know, a lot of new capital and wealth creation that is associated to the energy transition. And it really matters who's going to own this new capital. So I would really prefer that, you know, European multinationals start to really pay their taxes in African countries, for instance, so that African nations have resources to invest in these technologies and to be able to, you know, then export this these electrons, this electricity to the rest of the world. So I think it's important here to have, you know, this kind of a systemic understanding that there's also things that the European Union and their own multinationals are not yet doing when it comes to, you know, setting appropriate corporate tax rates and trying to evade, you know, taxes paid in different countries in the world. So that's one point. The second about carbon taxes regressive, I think that, you know, first thing, governments who do carbon taxation, well, they shouldn't do it. They shouldn't couple it with really regressive policies. If you do a carbon tax, you cannot do at the same time a highly regressive wealth tax. That's, you know, it's sure that it's not going to work. The second point, it needs to be planned in advance. And carbon taxes are not the silver bullet. They are important, but you really need to do these investments also at the same time, or to plan investments in advance, like, you know, the Swedish example is showing. You need to provide people with alternatives. And if you don't have already invested in the alternatives beforehand, then it's extremely important to have good compensation packages. And this should go, and, you know, examples where, you know, carbon taxes work also show that it works generally better and it works well when you include your carbon tax in a, you know, in a general reform of the tax system that makes it more progressive rather than more regressive. So you can also compensate the losers by reducing, for instance, the VAT taxes on the low income groups or on the middle income group, so that, you know, in the end, these guys become overall winners rather than clear and net losers of these environmental policies. And third, the elephant graph. Is it that surprising? Well, actually not really, because you have a relatively strong connection within countries and at the world level between what's your income and what's your emissions. And this relationship is even more important when we start to think beyond consumption, but also we include investments. So basically, very rich people, they emit a lot of carbon because they consume a lot of SUVs, of air tickets, air travel, but also because they have a lot of assets. And these assets also generate some carbon emissions. So the elephant curve can be seen on this graph, but I'd like to stress also a slight difference that I presented. This difference is that when you look at emissions per capita of the Western middle class, it has been declining. So actually this reinforces the gap in a way between those at the very, very top whose emissions have continued to increase and by fairly big amounts, and the middle income groups and the low income groups in the north whose emissions have already started to decline.
Great. Thank you very much. We have lots of questions. I'm going to have to make a selection here. Let me also say, Alina, in this next round, after Lucas, if you want to say anything on any of the questions, we'll go back to you as well. Because you just mentioned I'm trying to look for the questions that I've seen here before, but you were just talking about the decline of those 40%. There was a question asked specifically on that, which now, for whatever reason, I can't find, but it was, the question was whether that decline in the consumption of the middle 40% was due to gains in energy efficiency in consumption, or was actually due to declines in consumption or relative consumption, the question asked. And I'm sorry if I butchered the question because I can't find it anymore, there are too many, but this was what I remember from reading it. Now let me find two more that I had picked on here. One is from Zoe, a graduate from the University of Sussex. She just asks very simply, what are some examples of assets that the top percentile of earners are investing in that you would suggest taxing? So I think these are not the consumption goods, but the assets they're investing in that you would suggest taxing. That's one. And then there is one very interesting question here from Gillian Chan. Could you speak to socio-ecological policy transitions with respect to indigenous rights? For example, there was recently a dispute in Norway over the construction of wind farms on Sami native lands, which threatens the livelihood of those communities. Given the general trend of indigenous communities across the world being relatively politically and socio-economically disadvantaged, what are some considerations that could account for social justice for these communities when approaching environmental policy? That's Gillian, an LSE student. So let's try those three, and I'll go over to Alina as well, and I'll pick some more. Thanks. Luca.
Thank you again for the questions. So first one on the middle 40%. Unfortunately, it's a combination of both. Especially when you look at the stagnation or the near complete stagnations of income at the bottom of the distribution in the US over 40 years, you know, near zero growth for half of the American population over, you know, four decades. So this indeed is going to play a lot in the trends that we observe. That being said, since, let's say, you know, the second oil shock, early 1980s, and reinforced after the 2008 crisis, you do see some relatively significant changes in the energy mix and the energy patterns of nations. And so you do see a reduction in energy consumption levels, per capita. Not fast enough, clearly not at the pace that is required, but this is going into some relatively good direction, at least in some countries. And here again, what's interesting is the diversity of trajectories, which show, you know, different pathways are possible. Some are relatively bad and others are going in a relatively good direction. Again, I don't want to be too pro-Swedish here, but Sweden today has 50% renewables in its total energy mix. And it's not, you know, it didn't collapse. Its economy didn't collapse. That was the first point. The second point, what assets are we talking about? Well, you know, if you own, you know, a share of Shell, a share of Total, I think this is something that is pretty evident that needs to be addressed. But it's not just about owning these oil majors. It's also about all the investment choices that are made today by companies in the world in whether or not they're going to use machines that are highly carbon intensive, that have low efficiency versus machines that, you know, use green energy and that have high efficiency. Once these choices are being made, then you're stuck in these infrastructures for 5, 10, 50 years. We cannot, you know, just ask consumers to bear the entire responsibility for making these choices. And this is the general assumption we make when we only think about carbon taxes on consumers, which is what generally is done in this field. So we also need to think about, you know, these investor choices. That was the second point. And third point about indigenous right. The interest development I see is, you know, these new court cases in front of governments by communities, so whether indigenous communities or whether, you know, activist groups who go to the government and who say in matters of climate justice, for now, you are not doing things at the level of, you know, your engagements with respect to the COP21 in Paris, Climate Paris Conference, or other agreements, objectives presented by the governments. So you see a rising importance of courts to challenge and to constrain governments. And I think this can really benefit activist groups, indigenous groups. And I think this is a very positive development that is happening right now. And some of these cases, we're also in the Netherlands. We've seen some in France and in other countries in the world. So I think this is going to develop, and it's a very positive message.
Alina, please.
I just wanted to come to add a little bit on the last question on policy innovations to address indigenous rights. I think in addition to what Lucas has noted on the role of court and in litigation, in climate change area, we're also noticing more and more governments picking it up as part of climate legislation process. And for example, the climate legislation of Peru specifically requires the government to address the interests and rights of indigenous people and requires the government to consult with representatives of indigenous people, which I think is it's very, very important development. And we have also seen the shift as to how this issue is picked up internationally. I think it's very true that there are some countries which are resisting any mention or any requirement being put as to this issue at the international level, but we have seen increased participation and explicit recognition of indigenous groups as one of the constituencies under the UNFCCC negotiations. So they attend the negotiations and they voice their concerns and they make sure that the concerns are addressed in the new international agreements. And I think the Paris Agreement makes mention to that as well. So I think these are very important developments, but we still, of course, need to do more on this.
Thank you, Alina. So we are at 1 minute to go. I'm abusing my chair prerogative here. I'm going to just ask two more questions really quickly. I go back to Lucas for those two questions and then offer Lucas a chance also to make any concluding remarks at that time, and then we'll end. So the two last questions, one is from Stella Lord, and since you came back to Sweden recently, Lucas, in talking about Sweden again, her question, which was here early on, is, where does biomass come from in Sweden? Biomass in Nova Scotia, Canada, comes from wood pellets, and there's a lot of pushback from environmentalists on that. So on the nature of biomass in Sweden. And then since we are in Canada, another one is from Ariane de Haan from the IDRC. He says, thank you very much, Lucas, looks forward to reading your book. I was very happy to hear you highlighting gaps between popular perceptions and empirical data. Not everybody is a statistician, except perhaps in Sweden. Any thoughts on how our discipline can do better to explain our findings and address the disinformation pandemic? Good one to end on. So over to you, Luca, and then we'll conclude.
Thank you, Chico. About biomass, renewable wood. And of course, if you just chop down trees and you burn them and you don't replant, this is going to be a big problem for your environment. So really the question is about being able to sustain renewable forest. And you have, you know, such examples of successful renewable wood industries. And Sweden, again, is an interesting example, but you have other places in the world that do that right. About, you know, the question of statistics and the role of numbers into this general discussion that we're having, my answer would be that we need to put this information in a format that is easily accessible. And I know this is not always easy for statisticians, because we are, you know, trained to think about, you know, little details, little caveats, and sometimes we'd like to present like not one series, but 10, because there are a lot of assumptions behind. But I think it's also our job as economists, as statisticians, to engage with the general public in a language that is a common language. So we need to make sure that there are, you know, precise documents and methodological documents which show the complexity of how we construct these data. But we also need to have spaces where we engage with everybody that is not, you know, totally used to these complexities, so that can see simple and clear messages. And then we can open the box of how it's constructed and of all the difficulties that we have day to day when we work with this information. This is what we're trying to do on the World Inequality Database. I highly encourage you to go have a look. This is what other groups are also doing when it comes to inequality data or to, you know, other forms of data. I'm thinking of for instance, our World in Data. And so I think, you know, this is the kind of development that I would really support and go for.
Thank you very much, Lucas. I thought you would like to end on that question, because I know you how you feel about it. So let me thank Lucas and Alina very much for having joined us today. Lucas for sharing his new book, which has just been launched. Alina for her comments. Let me also thank Lisa Ryan and Nina Longcar from the team who've made it possible. But most of all, to thank all of you. There were over 140 of you in the call at one point. Thank you all for joining us today from various different countries in the world. I hope to see many of you again in our forthcoming events. So thanks for joining us, and thanks again to our speakers. Have a good evening in Europe, a good afternoon in North America. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much.